Hey, welcome to the Happy Rant Podcast. I am Ted Kluck, joined as always in studio by my good friend, my partner in radio, Barnabas Piper. Pipe, Ronald is back on the road, back off the show. Didn't even hit the group chat this morning, kept it ambiguous. I think he's resting up for his big Super Bowl tweet. He's got to get that Super Bowl Sunday tweet composed and ready to go. That'll probably be the next time we hear from him. But it's just you and me today, man. And I know that something I need in my life, especially today, because today sucks, is some Bible and some audio Bible. And thankfully, we have a resource for that. Pipe, tell them about Dwell Bible.
Yeah, listeners. So Dwell Bible is our favorite audio Bible app. As far as I'm aware, it's the best one out there. You know, come back at me if you know of something better. I just was having a conversation with two of the guys I work with, and one of them serves on our worship team. The other one's one of our tech guys, and the tech guy was just like, "Hey, guys, you guys kind of know the Bible and the audio realm. What's the best audio?" He wanted just an audio Bible, like to download a book. And I was like, "You need to check out Dwell." And the other guy was like, "Yes, absolutely. I use Dwell every day when I go running. I love the kind of musical underlay that they have because it kind of gives just a nice rhythmic, it kind of gets you in the focused zone of listening." So just sort of proof in the pudding of how people use this. This guy just ran the Nashville Marathon not too long ago. So he spends a lot of time running. Dwell is his regular companion on that. So that's a way it can be used. He mentioned the music. There's multiple ways you can kind of embed that. He even talked about, so he was kind of doing my sales pitch for me, which was great. As he was like, he liked the playlists where there's lists of kind of thematic readings, or, you know, the sermons of Jesus or the promises or the benedictions of Paul or these different things. So all of that is built in, basically allowing you to come to scripture for what you need, as well as, I mean, there's whole listening plans to get through the Bible in a year or 6 months or whatever. All of that is built in. If you go to dwellapp.io/happyrant, you'll see the discounts they offer to our listeners. It is a 30% discount off the lifetime subscription, a 10% discount off the annual subscription. You may initially kind of balk at the cost. It's totally worth it. And this is not a static thing. They continue to upgrade. They continue to build out features and lists and narrators and Bible versions and giving more and more ways to get scripture into your life afresh. So again, dwellapp.io/happyrant. Encourage you to check that out today. I was listening to it earlier this week, getting ready to preach at another church, just kind of chewing over the text, playing it on repeat to just kind of absorb it. It's a great way to do that. So go check it out today. It's totally worth it.
Dude, I do that too. When I speak, I always listen to the passage on Dwell for several days leading up. Yeah, absolutely love Dwell. Great people to work with, great product. But speaking of things that suck, like my day, let's talk about the David Brooks piece. controversial.
Dude, you've just started us off like you just kicked someone's dog is what you just did.
I did. Dude, I kicked someone's dog named David Brooks probably because there's a certain kind of Christian that has a love affair with the idea of David Brooks. The idea of a person like David Brooks. And what happened was I read this story. I have to tell you how I like experienced this story and see if you get a kick out of that. And then we can talk about less about the story itself and more about this type of piece, which I think is probably getting written every 10 to 12 years and usually getting it wrong. But people seem to love this kind of piece. Anyway, I thought that a friend of mine was going to be taking like the big hero shot of Russ Moore. And if you've seen the piece, you know that like the people that got the big hero treatment in it, they also got like an attendant, like superhero shot, like a glamour shot, kind of shot from below with them sort of, you know, throwing their shoulders back and staring pensively off into the distance. And it was amazing, you know, just as hero shots go. But my buddy ended up not shooting the story, but I ended up reading the story because I thought he was gonna. And I read it, And
so
you read it
for the pictures. That's where we're at.
Classic. That's on brand for me. I read it and I thought it was bad. I thought it was just a bad example of a feature. I mean, I think David Brooks is a good column writer. Like he's good when it's his voice. But this seemed to be kind of a machine gun. Every quote unquote evangelical who's ever published a book and who's ever also said they don't like Trump just got the hero treatment in this piece. So it was just kind of a machine gun feature with a whole bunch of things mashed together. And I finished it and I had a weird response because, you know, I'm pathologically Midwestern and I avoid conflict at all costs. But I was basically like, I have to fight with somebody about this. And which is a thing that I want to hear you on, because I feel like you have that.
And you don't even have Twitter to go to for this.
So I texted my friend, my best friend, who I know likes David Brooks. And
you're Jared C. Wilson.
Dude, yes. And so I dropped in this link, and I love my best friend, obviously. And I kind of like David Brooks. I mean, I'm not a fan, but I'm not like, you know, immediately against everything he has to say. Anyway, I dropped in the link and I was like, hey, did you read this? You know, and then being that both of us are pathologically Midwestern, we proceeded for the rest of the day to go back and forth, like equal parts trying not to offend each other, but also trying desperately to have the last word. And
exhausting. Maybe that's why you're having a bad day today. It's like residual effect of that.
I think so. I think I'm like, I have rhetorical hangover from that experience. But respond to any of that, Pipe.
So I did not read the piece. I more saw people fighting about it, which is usually a thing that makes me not want to read something. I'm like, oh, everybody's...
That's a good impulse.
You know, you kind of look at the crowd who's praising it. You look at the crowd who's hating it. You look at the interactions and you go, I think I know everything I need to know emotionally, not necessarily factually, but to go, this is, I'm gonna avoid this, this S storm, if you will. And, so... Like you, I lean positive towards David Brooks. Like he's not a must read for me. I don't go out of my way to read him. He has written some stuff. He is a consistently thoughtful voice, which I appreciate. Yeah. You know, he doesn't just fall into tropes, generally speaking, as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't matter kind of where you fall on the political or theological spectrum. If you are persistently thoughtful, I appreciate you. But my understanding is it was an article basically like there is a group of sort of evangelical dissidents, those who are not falling into the political evangelical definition, but trying to redeem evangelicalism, if you will, out of the political and into, although it's funny because
it was totally political.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But like at least out of the political, like, we are leashed to a political party kind of thing. All of this is a bit odd to talk about on the podcast because we tend to eschew politics for,
as we should,
so many obvious reasons. I read it and it's not the kind of thing that would stir me up to want to fight with somebody because that's what's been happening for the last 6 years.
I know.
You know, since the 2016 presidential election, like, what have we been doing except fighting about the term evangelicalism? Who are evangelicals bowing the knee to? Who's leaving evangelicalism? It's not that I don't care. It's that I can't care. It has been beaten out of me. I've lost care.
That's well said. And I tried caring for a day and it was awful. It was really awful. It was a terrible experience. And for people who like care on a regular basis, I don't know where they find the energy. It's a lot to carry around.
Yeah. And I we've talked, I mean, I think the last episode we did, we talked about, kind of the, how Twitter and social media reinforces misery by telling you how miserable you should be. I feel like in this case, it reinforces anger by telling you how upset you should be or how loyal you should be instead of just, I think I'm at my kind of political most level-headed when I can take a step back and go, what are the things that I value?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
And you kind of start to lay them out. And where does the gospel fit or not fit in those things? Because that's really the dictator of, are they good? Are they bad? Are they just societal neutrals? Those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And pieces like this are, they're accidental hero worship.
Yeah.
Or maybe not accidental. But the idea of like, we are staking our hopes on this. And I don't care, and I don't think it's necessary, and I'm not staking my hopes on the AND campaign, although I think what they're doing is excellent. I think it matters. I'm not staking my hopes on Russell Moore, although I consider him a friend, and he's a great man. And I don't think he would want me to stake my hopes on him. So all of this is, if it could have been written in a way that was like, these people are doing some good work, and they're worthy of your consideration. The problem is, that doesn't, unless you make a really strong statement, the piece doesn't move. Nobody cares about kind of nods towards something.
Yeah, I think there were elements of it that really surprised me. One of which was like the way that the New York Times, in a lot of people's minds, is still a big status conferral engine. You know, like people were really like blown away by the New York Times element of this, and like, wow, the Times gave two whole pages to evangelicals. And I'm like, the Times is just a place where a certain type of person goes to get their values reassured and be entertained. And in that, it is like every other media outlet that there is right now.
The Times is a business. They make their money from getting people to read what they put out. And if that's from stirring up evangelicals or ex-evangelicals or non-evangelicals or van-evangelicals or whatever. The powers that be. And I'm not saying this is David Brooks' intention, although I'm sure that, I mean, you and I both know this, having done a fair amount of internet writing, the thought of clicks cannot be escaped. Sure. We never write with entirely pure awareness.
Yeah.
But the powers that be run that piece, they give it that space because they're like, oh, this is going to work.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, you absolutely. Know? And it did work. And I had a friend explain it to me kind of like this, and I thought this was really good as a way to think about David Brooks. My friend was like, I often like the diagnoses, right? So I like the way he sees the landscape and diagnoses it sometimes, but I'm not taking the prescription, you know? Because like, in a way, why would I listen to this guy? This guy doesn't probably even love the Lord.
Well, I think, you know, maybe I'm thinking of Ross Douthat, because I get the two confused because they're both conservatives in a public space, and you know those guys all run together. Ross, I think Ross Douthat is a committed Catholic, so actively living out a practicing Catholic, actively living out his Catholic faith. I thought Brooks might be as well, but he might just be more of a kind of moral, you know. Have sort of a Judeo-Christian moral ethic, but not be explicitly Christian.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's definitely interested in morals. And he's definitely interested, it seems to be, in what always ends up being like his version of morality. Which is why I thought the piece, it struck me as a little lazy. And again, we're not getting into politics here, but it seemed like kind of a one-metric piece. You know what I mean? Like, we wouldn't evaluate all quarterbacks just on hand size. And if a guy has gigantic hands, that means he's going to be amazing. But this was like a one metric piece. Like if you dislike Trump, you're getting the hero treatment. And it doesn't matter what you think about a whole boatload of other things. And there are people in there that I really respect. There are people in there that I don't respect at all. And then there are a bunch of people in between, but it was a really big roster, you know. It was strange in that way. And I think the thing that really occurred to me, though, is how saleable this kind of piece always is. Because I guarantee you 15 years ago, somebody was writing the same piece, probably also in the Times, and maybe it was David Brooks, about, you know, Rob Bell and Brian McLaren and Doug Padgett and Mark Driscoll and, you know, Dan Kimball, like, these guys are going to save evangelicalism. And it's like, how'd that work out? You know, not great.
Yeah, there's so many layers to this.
Yeah.
The saving Christendom, let's move it out of evangelicalism, because that's a term I don't know if you and I agree on what it means, because I'm not sure that either of us know anymore.
I have no idea.
It's sort of like, it's just talking about like gobbledygook. Who knew? Okay,
term is like,
what are we arguing about?
It's like empathy, which
used to mean
the
something.
The actual meaning of empathy is just you agree with me. And the actual meaning of gaslighting is you disagree with me. You know, at the end of the day, this is what these things mean. But
let's just move it into like Christendom. So saving of Christ, because that's really what we're talking about here. We're not talking about saving or kind of the hero worship of people who are saving a version of Christianity. Like, we're talking about this idea of like these people are saving conservative Christianity, Bible believing Christianity, whatever. I'm never interested in the who's going to save this thing. I'm interested in who's saying things that are worthy of listening to. So I mentioned the AND campaign. I think they are absolutely worthy of respect and attention, and they're not saving anything. You know, they're a cog in God's machine of kingdom movement. And, you know, I think the same for Russell Moore. And I think Russell Moore thinks the same for Russell Moore. Like, he's trying to faithfully do his little piece. And, I was having a conversation with a guy recently. We were talking about how much Americans love narrative. And I think it's just Americans. We love narrative.
Yeah.
And so we talk about, a piece like this paints a narrative of, you know, these are the key things in saving this evangelicalism or Christendom or whatever. And what the realization that I had in that conversation was the best narratives we have ever read, be it the storyline of the Bible or the Lord of the Rings or, you know, the East of Eden, the greatest novels, have so many plot lines happening at once.
Mm-hmm.
And the characters are not aware of them. Like, the characters don't know what's happening in their own plot line. They think they're running things, and then there's something bigger going on. They think they're making a decision that's going to have this effect, and it's part of this huge sweeping thing. Well, that's this story. It is an observation of a tiny plot line in this great big whatever's going on. And so it says we're going to save this, and in reality, it's like you're just one thread of one plot line in a narrative that's beyond all of this. And so it's not hard for me to shrug at this stuff and go,
yeah,
I give it 5 years, you know?
Yeah.
Then we'll have a keener sense of what impact this played, or maybe we won't. Maybe all this will fizzle. Maybe we won't ever totally understand it. Just getting hung up on it emotionally feels fruitless to me.
Yeah, that's 100% correct. And it occurs to me that if we're really paying attention to a lot of scripture, it's pretty apparent that we're not really going to have a brand that makes it, you know, like, and yet we continue to be hung up on this brand making it. And, I don't know, maybe I'm just the pessimist in that regard, but, I could probably do with a little bit more optimism. But anyway, it was a classic like 2022 feature in that it really existed for like a day and a half. And then it was gone, you know, like completely gone.
It is a huge deal until we all forget about it on Wednesday.
Yeah. It's a little annoying that I'm bringing it up, you know, that's like when people hear this, they'll be like, oh, I've already dealt with that 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, by the time this comes out, nobody will remember that the piece existed, which I think is evidence that it's worth it to not get that hung up on it. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, the flip side of that is that there are often things that are well worth consideration that we also forget about, either horrible things that happen that we forget about or things that are thought-provoking and encouraging, and we forget about those too. You know, that's just the speed of our, I would say processing, but it's more just the speed of our, you know, amnesia.
Well, and I think there's a real, I'm reading the pastoral epistles right now to prep for a speaking thing next summer. And there's so much space in those given to false teachers. So we are supposed to grapple with issues of what's true and what's not true, and who are we platforming and who are we listening to, and how do we diagnose, how do we combat? Like, there's a lot said about that. So we do have to take that seriously. And I think, like, my kind of 90s ironic detachment kicks in to, like, such a degree that I need to remind myself, like, no, I need to care, if only so that I can help my kids understand it better or whatever. But I don't need to fight about it, you know?
Yes, because caring about it means, honestly, the way to care about it is to care about the truth, you know?
That's
maintain
right.
a hold on the truth as defined, you know, by scripture in terms of how do we faithfully live out a Christian conviction? Because if you're caring about it by trying to be aware of or respond to every false teacher, every perceived false teacher, the faults in teaching, whatever, you're just playing political and theological whack-a-mole, and it's the game that never ends. Like, you never win.
Right.
They never right. like, the time limit doesn't come to an end, and you don't get the big stuffed animal at the end. Like, you just are perpetually smacking away at things, trying to solve them. And meanwhile, everybody who's hanging out with you is bored. Like, they're disinterested. Yeah. You're not helping anybody. And I mean, that piece feels like, I'm sure there was some beneficial contributions. It's beneficial to highlight good work that people are doing and so forth.
Yeah.
Getting hung up on it on either side feels like political, theological whack-a-mole to me, you know? And
yeah.
Now there are, I think as you know, you're responsible to some degree for influencing and discipling college students. I am responsible for the people in my church. Yeah. I think we need to be aware of trends, but not every single instance. Hey, did you read this book? Did you hear about this? Like, we need to be aware of the divisive trends. I think that's probably our level of responding to false teaching, but not like,
dude, I'll say this,
shoot down every piece.
I want to get your take on it. Cause you work with young people in a church setting. I work with young people in a school setting. The New York Times is the moon to my students. Like, they did not see this piece. They're not on Twitter. They're not reading people who are angry about the piece. Like, I didn't bring it up in the classroom. Like, they're not interacting with it in any way. Mm-hmm. Which begs the question, what is their New York Times?
TikTok.
I mean,
I'm not saying that ironically, like, those kids are so into the TikTok.
Yeah, no, I'm really asking. Yeah.
It's that world of social media, I don't want to say influencers, because that's a whole other kind of thing, but like social media pundits, let's say,
is
there's a reason why, I mean, I think this came up on the show several months ago. So there's a reason why my brother has over 1 million TikTok followers for 60-second videos, some of which are, you know, theological kind of takedowns of, well, I shouldn't say theological, they're kind of anti-theological. He's pretty agnostic. Some of them are political. And then a lot of it is just like clever wordplay, grammar. Like, he's a smart, funny dude. And he doesn't have 1 million. The 1 million people who are following him are probably not overlapping much in the Venn diagram of New York Times readers. Those people are the ones who are arguing on Twitter about the roles of women in the church and so forth. Mm-hmm. And the TikTok crowd is a different place. So it's the deconstruction crowd. And I don't say that tongue in cheek. Like, it is a genuine, there is a subset of a generation who is weighing right now, is the church worth sticking with?
Yeah.
And they're getting their information from places like TikTok, or hopefully from genuine relationships. But I think it's that. I think if you were going to make the divide, it'd be like that would kind of be the if you were going to label them, I'd do it that way.
Yeah. No, that's helpful. That's really interesting.
YouTube as well. And we talked about this as well, the how out of touch we feel with the generation below us, or two generations below us, whatever it is, where, like, if you say who's the most popular YouTuber, I genuinely couldn't name one. They know who it is off the top of their head. Well, we're playing different ball games right now.
Yeah, that's very true. Let me ask you this, kind of as a bridge to our other topic, which I thought was really interesting. Do you think young people right now are more or less, quote unquote, passionate about things than we were at like in the 90s. Because something you said,
I thought everybody in the 90s was dispassionate.
That's the thing. That's what I was getting at. We were dispassionate. We were kind of faux deep. Like, we wanted credit for being deep, but we didn't want to do the work, you know? And I don't know. I think today's generation sort of wants to be, they want to take the credit for being passionate, but they don't want to do the work either. Which is maybe two sides of the same coin. I don't know. What are you seeing out there?
Well, I think, yeah, it's an interesting mix, because I think what you're describing, I think what you're seeing is like the disaffected dispassion of a Gen X person. So like my brother's a good example. Just a dyed in the wool Gen Xer. And that influence on young people. So young people, I think, are very passionate. I sound old? Young people. Say college.
Yeah, I know.
People.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they are really passionate. They're asking really pointed questions. They're really exploring meaning and truth and purpose and direction. And they're really they're trying to figure out authenticity. Who can be trusted? Who can't be trusted? Is the church worthy of trust? Are political parties worthy of trust? And so forth. Like, they're kind of, because they've now been handed the keys to adulthood, they have to make these decisions. They were raised in a you know, staunchly Republican home or whatever. And they're kind of like, is this my direction, or is this the direction I was handed? And when they get the Gen X influence, those questions are answered with a lack of answers, because the disaffected Gen X thing is like, man, none of it matters, or you can't trust any of that, or that's all BS. And as opposed to a kind of, all right, well, let's walk through this and find out what the truth is. You know, there's a reason why during the 90s and the rise of kind of the Gen X mindset, like postmodernism, the idea of like, or being in a post-truth society came to fashion. Because it was so much easier to just shrug and be like, man, nobody knows.
Yeah, and exactly.
Or nothing means anything. And I don't think that's the way that current 18 to 20 year olds think. But those are the people who are mostly giving them answers, as far as I can tell.
18 to 20 year olds, they kind of, depending on who they're trying to impress, they know what they're supposed to think. I don't know if they know what they do think, but they know what they're supposed to think. They're being fed the right answers all the time. And, you know, you see them on either side of the aisle kind of regurgitating the right answers. But I don't know if they're any more or less passionate than we were. I think something that I see is that and we're getting a little far afield here. I don't see them really being into anything. Like, I remember in the 90s, everything that I was into was stupid, but I was really into it, and I could talk about it at length. You know, like I could go 20 minutes on Pearl Jam or, you know, why I liked a certain football team, or, you know, why I think, I don't know, radio stations are cool or whatever. Like, I could do a lot of content on things that I was into, and I was always into something. But I'm not sure I see that anymore, you know?
How much of that is because of, again, I mean, we were talking about how fast news goes by, or like controversial posts or whatever. The same is true for like musicians. You know, like Pearl Jam mattered in the 90s because Pearl Jam was a big band for a bunch of years, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, when we talk about 90s hip hop, like, yes, there was a migration, but like, there were hip hop artists who were a big deal in 1992 who were still a big deal in 1999. That is not the case anymore.
No, that's so true. They come and go in like months.
Yeah.
Like, and even
what used to be like a summer hit is now a summer artist. Like, you think about,
absolutely.
So the Super Bowl halftime show last year was, I think, The Weeknd. And he did that weird thing with the mirrors and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
Except that feels like it was 14 and a half years ago. Like, in my mind, he played right after Prince played the halftime show in Miami.
Exactly.
In like 1996 or whatever it was.
Right after U2 did it in, yes. you know,
And then Shania Twain was in there somewhere. Like, it's that's how fast we move on from popular things. So how do you get into anything if you're constantly keeping up with what the next thing is?
Yeah, that's a great point. And like, I think, so I'm reading this book, and the thesis of it is that like the 90s are the last decade to like have a decade. In that, like, if we talk about like Tupac, and we're talking about him in the context of the 90s, and we're talking about him in the context of like the East Coast and West Coast, you know, rap battles and guys dissing each other on tracks and then sometimes shooting each other. And, you know, like all of that is a very 90s motif. But if you were to tell me that like Taylor Swift released All Too Well in 2002, or if you were to tell me that she released All Too Well in 2017, I would believe both things. And I would have no reason to not believe both things. You know what I mean? Because there's no sort of beginning and end to decades anymore. It's all just kind of a mishmash to me. As a result, I don't see, people don't sit with an artist or even with a genre or anything long enough to be passionate about it. You know, like if you're lucky, you catch The Weeknd at some show, and then yeah, a year and a half later, nobody's talking about that artist anymore.
Yeah, and it's I'm trying to think how to say it. Like you think historically, so think back to the last century and the distinctions of decades in our minds looking back. You know, the 1910s don't look like much to me in my mind. Yeah. The 1920s do. You know, you got the roaring 20s, then you got the 30s. So it was, you know, you got the crash in 29, and then there was the depression. The 1940s was coming out of the depression into World War II, and then there was the boom, and then the 50s was kind of the like establishment of the American dream.
Yeah.
Also the rise of the civil rights movement. You got the 60s when everything was disrupted. You know, everything from like free love to the civil rights movement and turning all this stuff over. You got the 70s, which was kind of a like a hangover from the 60s. Not quite sure what to do. Bit depressed. The 80s, there was so much technological and economic kind of upheaval. And then you get to the 90s, and it's like it's kind of a thriving kind of thing where there's, you know, economically we're good, artistically there's so much happening and all this stuff. And then you get to the 2000s, and the rate of change doesn't slow down, but it fragments. So it's really hard to label trends, it seems like. And, you know, and then you get the 2010s, and then now the 2000s, then the 2010s, and now we're into the 2020s. I don't know what, what is a historian 100 years from now going to look back and say about our trends?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. And how product comes out anymore has totally changed that. And like, this book makes the argument that there are very few like monocultural moments anymore. Like moments like the O.J. Simpson Bronco chase, where like everybody's watching it together. Everybody remembers where they were, or even like a random episode of Seinfeld that airs on a Thursday night. Like more people watched some random season 4 Seinfeld episode than watched the finale of Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Just like numbers wise. But we think about those, like the Game of Thrones prestige TV moment as like the big monocultural people coming together. But it's like, it's really not even that many people, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, a season finale of Seinfeld in the mid 90s would have drawn like 60 million people or something like that, which at the time was a third of the country.
Yeah.
And now, Game of Thrones live probably got like a great viewing would be like 4 to 7 million or something like that.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I remember when Seinfeld, the series, like the whole thing ended, I was living in Indianapolis working for a radio station, like hoping we didn't have an event that I had to work so that I could actually watch the show. Right. Like it was really important to see it. 'Cause if I didn't see it, I was screwed until the next summer when reruns started to come out. Like, I, you know, back then, if you didn't see something, you didn't see it. And, you know, I just think so many things are different, which I think is maybe why the David Brooks piece was like momentarily charming. It seemed like a little bit of that monoculture energy where it's like, okay, for like a day and a half, it's game on with this thing. And I know if something gets to me, then it's gotten to everybody else already, you know? So I'm like, if this has gotten to me, that means everybody's
Pony Express finally made it to Jackson, Tennessee.
Yeah, exactly. The Western Union telegram, you know, made it to my doorstep, and I'm experiencing this thing. But Pipe, this has been fascinating. My question to you at this point is, do we want to wrap it and then do a Patreon?
Or yeah, why don't we wrap it? I feel like if we go anywhere from here, we're just sort of like changing subjects dramatically, and that's fine. But, you know, let's save those for a future episode.
35 minutes of solid radio. I can live with that. Pipe, we've done what we always do on this program, which is drag a David Brooks story that everybody else was done either dragging or celebrating 3 weeks ago. We're nothing if not timely on this program. And we talked a little 90s, which I always love to do. And until next time.
The Happy Rant is brought to you by Resonate Recordings. If you go to resonaterecordings.com, you can see the full range of services they offer. So if you're considering starting a podcast, they are the ones we recommend going with. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see their prices, to connect with them and ask any questions, and to see what they can do to help you launch, edit, master, and improve your podcast. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see what they can do to help you launch and improve your podcast.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.